If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, New Orleans, the latest city the Trump administration is targeting for aggressive immigration enforcement.
Also, President Trump says he has no problem releasing additional video of the U.S. follow-up attack on a suspected drug boat. Here's what the defense secretary said about that.
We're reviewing it right now to make sure sources, methods, I mean, it's an ongoing operation.
And born to Korean parents adopted in Oregon, an author searched for her birth family and wished she'd had an open adoption.
I remember thinking this would be so much easier if I had just known them all along, you know, if I could always just ask them questions.
So what does she think now after a deep dive into open adoptions? That's coming up Here and Now.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Alina Habba, a former personal attorney for President Trump, is stepping down as the administration's top federal prosecutor in New Jersey. She's doing so after a federal appeals court found that she was unlawfully serving in the position. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
In a statement posted on social media, Alina Habba says she is resigning as the acting U.S. attorney for New Jersey. She says she's not surrendering in the face of legal challenges, but instead stepping down to protect the stability and integrity of the office. Still, she's leaving after a three-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit unanimously found that Habba had been unlawfully put into the U.S. attorney's job and disqualified her from supervising cases. That ruling was the latest blow to how President Trump has tried to install some U.S. attorneys. In her statement, Habba says she will continue to serve the Justice Department as a senior advisor to the Attorney General for U.S. attorneys. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The developer of an app known as IceBlock has sued the Trump administration. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the suit comes after Apple banned the IceBlock app under pressure from the White House.
IceBlock is an app that went viral for allowing users to anonymously send out alerts when Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents were conducting a raid. Joshua Aaron is the app's developer.
It would alert users within a five-mile radius of that location, and they would get a notification on their phone, and then they could make a decision on whether or not they wanted to be in that vicinity.
Attorney General Pam Bondi said the app endangers federal agents. Bondi has said Aaron is under investigation, and she convinced Apple to remove the app from its app store. Now Aaron is suing the Trump administration for violating his First Amendment rights and making unlawful threats against him for protected speech. The Justice Department and Apple did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will visit Washington again later this month for a meeting with President Trump and talks about the future of Gaza. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky reports from Tel Aviv.
This will be the fifth time Netanyahu visits the White House since President Trump's current term began in January. An Israeli government spokesperson says the meeting will take place on December 29th and that the Prime Minister will stay in Washington until after the new year. Netanyahu said on Sunday that he wants to use the meeting to talk about how to end Hamas rule in Gaza. Fighting in Gaza has continued sporadically despite a ceasefire in October. But a Hamas leader told NPR in Qatar that if there are negotiations leading to a Palestinian state, the group would agree to not use its weapons against Israel. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Dow is down 273 points or more than 0.5%. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Closing arguments were set to begin today in the San Francisco murder trial of filmmaker and journalist Kevin Epps. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara reports.
Epps is known for his documentary Straight Outta Hunters Point. He's charged with murder in the death of Marcus Polk, his sister-in-law's ex-husband. Though both sides acknowledge that Epps fatally shot Polk, the trial has centered on whether the killing was justified self-defense. The legal team for Epps conceded that he was guilty of possessing a firearm as a convicted felon, so even if he's found not guilty of murder, they say he will still be sentenced for that possession. Regardless of the outcome, closing arguments mean Epps is one step closer to the end of the legal battle that began when he was charged in 2019. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
An autonomous vehicle expert is calling incidents of Waymo cars passing stop school buses a troubling pattern for the Bay Area-based company. Waymo says it's issuing a voluntary software recall related to the incidents. Carnegie Mellon Emeritus Professor Philip Koopman has studied self-driving cars for 3 decades. He says it's alarming that Waymo allowed its cars to allegedly pass stop school buses in Austin, Texas, 19 times.
Why did the school district have to complain and resort to what amounts to public shaming before Waymo would fix it?
Waymo has said it moved quickly to address the issue and that no injuries occurred related to the recall. In sports, the Warriors beat the Bulls 123-91. The Sharks beat the Hurricanes 4-1. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Afternoon support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the sustaining members of KQED. Looks like sunny skies the rest of the day around the Bay Area, so says the Weather Service. Highs remain in the low 50s to the low to mid 60s far inland today. Sacramento, some fog still existing through the afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy, a high of 50 today.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour with a check-in on the latest city to be targeted by the Trump administration's crackdown on what they say is illegal immigration, New Orleans. Last week, federal agents arrested dozens of people in the city. The Department of Homeland Security said it was an effort to round up immigrants who were released after arrest for violent crimes. But data from the New York Times shows that most immigrants arrested this past year in high-profile city crackdowns have no criminal record. The AP did a study of the New Orleans arrests and found officials are releasing few details of arrests, and also that federal authorities are monitoring protesters and online criticism of agents. Immigration reporter Bobby G. Misick is with Verite News. Bobby, these raids started last week. What are you seeing in the city today?
So, you know, what's kind of funny about these raids is when you know, in my neighborhood, right, there's a large Hispanic population, but it's not like you see Border Patrol popping out of everywhere. But we continue to get reports of different neighborhoods where we're seeing a lot of activity, especially in suburbs like Kenner, which has a larger Hispanic population of folks that are mostly from Honduras. And what I've noticed is that although I have, you know, there are a lot of Hispanic folks in my community, they're not outside. People are afraid and they're hunkering down. Yeah. They're staying inside. They're not trying to leave their homes. They're not even maybe taking their kids to school. So that's kind of the vibe right now.
Well, we remember, I mean, there's so many different communities in New Orleans. We remember post the Vietnam War when a huge Vietnamese, an industrious Vietnamese population was in the city. But New Orleans has a much smaller immigrant community than other cities targeted in President Trump's deportation campaign. What are the theories behind why he's there?
So, you know, President Trump has kind of focused on and alluded to sending National Guard or other federal immigration agencies down to New Orleans for several months. And that rhetoric has been really welcomed by the governor, Jeff Landry, by state legislators, excuse me, and our attorney general here, who all say, you know, yes, come down. New Orleans has a major crime problem and undocumented immigrants are contributing to that problem, even though New Orleans is at a 50-year low in terms of crime rate. And as you mentioned, you know, very few people who are arrested in these crackdowns have any criminal histories. And that AP reporting that you mentioned also said that, you know, only a third of the people that were arrested in the first few days of this crackdown here had criminal records.
Right. And that AP report also pointed out that officials, federal officials, are monitoring protesters and online criticism of things like raids. What, I mean, do you know more about that? And how is the city responding to that?
You know, I think that the local activist community, you know, they've been really active for years before this crackdown. And those are folks that the agencies are monitoring. They seem pretty prepared for this. And, what I did see in that reporting was, you know, they're talking about how these groups are planning, you know, their own sort of like, you know, efforts to film activity, to film arrests from Border Patrol and ICE. And, you know, hopefully what we'll see is that they're allowed to do that and that, their constitutional rights will be,
sure,
will be maintained.
Sure. Freedom of speech and all. We just got about a little under 2 minutes here. You mentioned that the governor welcomed, the ICE agents and the immigration agents in. Well, it's also a tourist town that relies on businesses running. And you talked about, mm-hmm. You know, people being afraid to leave their homes. Is there concern about what impact this is going to have on this city that welcomes, you know, thousands of tourists every day?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. You know, the New York Times reported a story today about the ripple effect of this operation on the local restaurant industry that relies so heavily on immigrant labor. Dishwashers, prep cooks, line cooks, delivery drivers are not showing up for work. And that has, you know, we're only a week into this operation, less than a week, really. And you're seeing that has a ripple effect. There are certain items on menus that people aren't able to get. There are some restaurants that aren't offering certain items because their employees are too afraid to go to the stores and the markets where they need to pick those up. And one local grocery store chain that caters to a Hispanic clientele posted on its Facebook page that it had to stop deliveries due to overwhelming demand. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, we believe that demand is coming from people who are unwilling to leave their homes in this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are, you know, we've reported there are several Hispanic owned businesses that are closing for a while.
Oh. Bobby Jean Misick, who covers immigration for Verite News there in New Orleans. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Will the American people get a chance to see the full video of a September 2nd strike on a suspected Venezuelan drug boat? Here's what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said when he was asked about that over the weekend.
The most important thing to me are the ongoing operations in the Caribbean with our folks that use bespoke capabilities, techniques, procedures in the process. I'm way more interested in protecting that than anything else. So we're viewing the process and we'll see.
The Pentagon is under intense pressure to release the full video because a second strike on that boat on September 2nd led to the death of two survivors. The administration has defended its military campaign because it claims the boats are smuggling fentanyl into the United States. Let's get some more context about what is on those boats and where they may be going. Renata Segura is director of the Latin America and Caribbean Program for the International Crisis Group. It's a conflict prevention organization that researches drug trafficking. Renata, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So at his cabinet meeting last week, President Trump was asked about that September 2nd strike, and here was his response.
Well, look, all I know is this. Every boat that you see get blown up, we save 25,000 on average lives. 25,000 lives. They've been sending enough of this horrible fentanyl and other things, like cocaine and other things. But fentanyl right now is the leader of the pack to kill our entire nation.
So, Renata, the reporting on this has been pretty clear for weeks. The vast majority of fentanyl does not come from Venezuela. But since the president keeps saying it, let's continue to clarify. What is the truth?
Yeah, I mean, Venezuela is not a great country that produces a big amount of drugs, but there is a good amount of cocaine that is mostly produced in Colombia and Peru that is trafficked to Europe through Venezuela. If the president is concerned about fentanyl, that is very misguided. not a concern, but the fact that they're attacking Venezuelan boats. Most of the fentanyl that comes to the U.S. is produced in Mexico. I mean, we cannot say that they are not concerned about drugs. You know, it's clearly a problem that has brought quite a number of deaths to the United States. But these attacks that are happening are not reducing the amount of drugs that are available in the United States.
I see. So why do you think the president continues to insist that Venezuela is the source of fentanyl coming into the U.S.?
Well, I think that the administration has kind of a dual intent with what's happening in the Caribbean. On the one hand, yes, Trump campaigned promising that he was going to reduce the amount of drugs that were coming. And so he wants to continue to speak about this promise. But there's also others, like, for example, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who is very invested in actually getting the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, out of power. I don't think that the American public really has much appetite for regime change. This is something that the U.S. has been involved in multiple countries recently, and it has not really had great success. However, for understandable reasons, Americans are worried about drugs. So I think that by framing this regime change attempt as a question of limiting drugs, they're hoping that those people that are worried about their children being, you know, exposed to these drugs and perhaps overdosing would be supportive of a military intervention in Venezuela. Mm. So they're sort of conflating two different questions, I think.
The other question is, where are the boats actually going? CNN is reporting that the boat struck on September 2nd was on its way to meet a larger boat that was bound for Suriname. It's a South American country east of Venezuela. How often is the United States even the final destination for these drug boats? Do we know?
I mean, so the attacks at the beginning of when they started happening were mostly off the coast of Venezuela and through the Caribbean. And we know that that is a route that is mostly going to Europe, sometimes stopping in Africa, but the final destination is Europe. Then they switched to bomb some boats that were going on the Pacific, and it is likely that those were intending to get to the United States. But again, those were most likely carrying cocaine. Unfortunately, because the government hasn't shared any information about the intelligence that they claim they have on who were in the boats or what were the products that they were bringing, it's very difficult to say. They've been incredibly vague about all of the details. And we have seen a number of families of those people who have died, either saying that those people were not involved in trafficking at all. They were fishermen or were in the ocean for other reasons, or some of them just painting them as small traffickers, essentially locals who have very few opportunities for illicit livelihoods and who were involved just, you know, doing an errand, but not, let's say, something that is going to dramatically change the operations of the drug trafficking organizations in the area.
Renata Segura, Director of the Latin America and Caribbean Program for the International Crisis Group. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's Here and Now.
Scientists have discovered millions of new species on Earth since the 1700s, and we are averaging 17,000 more every year. But how many more are there?
The range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The mission to better understand life on our own planet, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Wow, the new things you learn when you listen to KQED News and All Things Considered. Hear more at 1 o'clock today.
Hi, it's Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm already drafting my New Year's resolutions. Among them, next year, I'm going to start drafting my resolutions even earlier. And, you know, well, read more books and stuff. But I'm also going to keep asking you to support public radio, because some things I just don't need to change. Thanks.
Visit kqed.org/donate.
Support for KQED also comes from Marin Country Mart at Larkspur Landing, an authentic 1970s village with more than 40 independent shops, a dozen eateries, and local services such as a toy store, bookstore, and barbershop. More at marincountrymart.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event, going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
It's Here and Now. Many of you are no doubt familiar with open adoptions, when the birth parents, usually the mother, are involved in some way with the life of the child they relinquish to another family. Today, 95% of adoptions are open to some degree. But these adoptions only became popular in the 1990s. Before that, birth moms often gave up children in shame and secrecy, never saw or heard from them again. Nicole Chung was born to Korean parents in the early 1980s, adopted by a family in a small town in Oregon. In her 20s, she set out to find her birth parents. It was tortuous and costly, and she wondered, are open adoptions better? Nicole had already written books like All You Can Ever Know and A Living Remedy about her own adoption. Her article on open adoptions in The Atlantic is When Adoption Promises Are Broken, and that title tells us a lot. Only half of states have any legal framework for open adoptions, and as to research, Nicole found a 2007 study that found birth mothers had far less grief in open adoptions than those in closed. But Nicole Chung, a professor at Drexel, told you when she asked research librarians to pull studies on birth mothers, there was none.
It's true, there is a real lack. There just isn't the amount there should be, considering how many lives adoption touches.
Let's go back. Yes, many birth mothers told you they still had some contact with children. It was largely positive. But many were, it would seem, sometimes brutally cut off. You found something called Ethical Family Building. This is a nonprofit. And a birth mother told you that there is this myth that open adoptions solve everything, but it's just that the hurts can be different.
Sure. Well, first, I want to say I do think there's a reason, right, that the vast majority of infant adoptions in this country today are now open. As you mentioned, it can look a lot of different ways with more or less ongoing contact, but it has become the default, and I think the reasons are pretty clear. The research we do have does indicate that birth mothers on average reported, you know, less grief, more satisfaction with that decision. And we also know that it tends to be better for adopted individuals who grow up with access to the type of answers I really didn't have access to, right, growing up in a closed adoption. And then in terms of the quote you just mentioned about how the hurts of open adoption are just different, I remember the birth mother who said this to me, and I believe something else she said in our conversation, and I'm paraphrasing, but in her open adoption, she has a front row seat to this pain and this grief of not raising her biological child. It's not that she regretted that decision. Kelsey was someone who told me she and her child's adoptive family have worked very hard to have a positive open adoption relationship that's very much focused on her child's needs. And it was still, this was one of those circumstances where it seemed to be about as well as open adoption goes. And it was still so difficult, right? And so when you just think about the level of loss that many birth mothers are dealing with, often without a lot of ongoing post-adoption support or counseling, right? Without a lot of guidance and advice in terms of just how do you have an open adoption relationship? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? How do you deal with communication challenges when they arise? Because any relationship in any family can have challenges. What do you do?
There's just no universal framework. And universal feeling. I mean, you were just saying that this was still painful, even though she had experienced an open adoption and had access. Some birth mothers choose not to do this because it's too painful for them.
Right.
But you speak to many who do and felt initially that they had a great relationship with the adoptive parents. There's a woman named Lindsay. It was very friendly, she said, the relationship when it started, but it started to shift when the little girl she'd relinquished turned 7 and started asking questions about her adoption. And that's when Lindsay stopped being invited to birthday parties. The letters and emails that were exchanged slowed down. Then she was told she couldn't visit at all. There's another mom, same thing, had a very warm relationship with the adoptive family, had an understanding that there would be sometime visits, but photos sent, letters exchanged. And then that adoptive family also asked to stop when the child turned 7 because they were worried that the child was going to ask questions and get confused.
Sure. So in many instances, often birth parents don't necessarily have something in writing in terms of post-adoption contact. If they do have something in writing, in about half the states, there's something called a court-enforceable post-adoption contact agreement where it could be filed with a local court. If there's a breach of this agreement, a birth mother might have legal recourse, which, you know, I will say there are a lot of practical and emotional barriers, right, to trying to enforce an agreement like that in court. But in about half the states, if a birth mother has an agreement like that, she might have the option. It, you know, it's still not common in many. And so many of the birth mothers I spoke to, they really didn't have anything in writing at all. It was more of an informal agreement. I was actually interested to learn that oftentimes, as you mentioned, birth mothers may be the ones to step back from the relationship. And it could be due in part to just trauma and how difficult it is to visit a child that you're not raising, and then to have to leave. I had several birth mothers tell me how, you know, how wrenching that was. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in terms of what the adoptive parents' rights are, once they are the legal parents, they're the only legal parents, they have all of the control. And so I talked to a birth mother and advocate who told me she doesn't know a birth mother who doesn't kind of walk on eggshells a little bit, even in the case of much more positive relationships, just because she knows access could be removed at any time. It may seem as though birth mothers have a great deal of power before placement. One birth mother told me they really kind of build you up. They tell you you can choose open adoption, the type of contact you want, how often, and all of that. And that is true to a point, but after an adoption is finalized, you know, the adoptive parents really do have a great deal of control, and the birth mother does not.
Well, there might be some sympathy for that. You know, fear on the part of the adoptive mother that a birth mother will drop out and the child will be hurt, or the birth mother will ask for too much contact.
I mean, I will say, too, while I am really sympathetic to all parties, but this type of adoption is not new, and it is very much the default in infant adoption. And there was a social worker I spoke with who told me if you aren't open to a more open adoption relationship, that might mean that domestic infant adoption is not the right type of adoption for you. I do think a real important point that emerged from my reporting was just how much education there really needs to be right pre-adoption, and how much support there needs to be post-adoption.
Well, and let's continue that education, or at least just sharing of experience with you. As we said, you hired an intermediary, paid a lot of money. They located your birth parents, but then they had to go find them and get consent from them. You finally do meet them. What did that mean to you?
I mean, I think about this a lot because what set me off on my search was actually I was expecting my first child. I myself was born severely premature, and I had no idea why, you know, and so I'm being asked all these questions at the prenatal appointment, like, what about this? What about this aspect? What was it like for your mother? And of course, I had no answers. I remember thinking this would be so much easier if I had just known them all along, you know, if I could always just ask them questions.
At 27, you got a sister and a biological sister.
Yes.
But how did it resonate at home? You found out that your adoptive parents never told you that your birth mother had tried to get pictures of you and to talk to you when you were about 6.
It's true. So I honestly think it really scared them. And so they said no. And they didn't tell me about her attempt to reach out to us until I was much older. I think around 16, 17 is when I found out.
And what did you think?
Gosh. I mean, honestly, I just remember being in shock. Again, growing up in a closed adoption, that meant no contact. I didn't even know their names. I didn't know if they ever thought about me. I was really surprised to hear that she'd reached out. And then I think I was, like, really shaken. You know, it stayed with me. It was something I thought about when I decided decades later that I would try to reach out to them.
Yeah. Well, I guess, what would you tell adoptive parents now?
It's so hard, right? I think that the older I get, the more empathy I have for my parents. I do understand their urge to protect me. I don't think there would have been a lot of guidance at that point. Do I wish they had told me? Maybe. Was I upset to find out as a teenager? It takes very little to upset a teenager. Yes, absolutely. But I also do understand, right? Like, yeah. It was a very different time. In general, though, I don't think it sends positive messages. There is this, like, you know, veneer of shame or of secrecy. There's these things we don't talk about. As an adoptee, this is just my own personal opinion. Kids find out what topics are sort of off limits. But I will say, by the time I was an adult and, like, searching for my birth family, my adoptive parents were really able to have those discussions with me. It wasn't always easy. They eventually met my sister and considered her family too. So I think they changed.
And what about you?
I had a tendency to maybe view open adoptions with a little bit of idealism. Like, I know it's not straightforward or easy. I know there can be all kinds of challenges, and it can be an emotional minefield, all of that.
Yeah. Well, you end the article by saying, "One thing you know for certain, I would never wish my adoption closed again," despite knowing how complicated open can be.
For me, finding my birth family and being able to get answers to questions I'd had all my life, that information kind of represented my inheritance, I guess, from them. So even though it is and continues to be quite complicated, I certainly don't regret it. I'm really thankful for the fact that I was able to open up my own adoption and to have a more complete story for myself and for my children.
Nicole Chung, her article in The Atlantic is "When Adoption Promises Are Broken." Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's Here and Now. From NPR News in Boston, I'm Sharon Brody. President Trump's former personal attorney, Alina Haba, resigned today as the top federal prosecutor for New Jersey. She left that job after an appeals court said she had been serving in the post unlawfully. Haba was appointed in March to serve a temporary term. She had no prior federal prosecutorial experience. In a post on social media today, Haba denounces the appeals court's ruling as political, and she says she stepped down to protect the stability and integrity of the office. President Trump today announced a $12 billion farm aid package. Farmers have struggled to sell their crops while getting hit by rising costs after the president raised tariffs on China. Paramount has launched a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. The effort announced today initiates a battle with Netflix for the company behind HBO, CNN, and DC Studios. Last week, Netflix reached a $72 billion deal to acquire Warner Brothers. A top European Union official today warned the United States against interfering in Europe's affairs. European Council President Antonio Costa said only European citizens can decide which party should govern them. The Trump administration's new national security strategy portrays European allies as weak and offers tacit support to far-right political parties. You're listening to Here and Now.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help the members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a theater, a better idea for healthcare. Digital Foundry, software consulting, helping global businesses design, build, and run innovative software since 1992. More online at digitalfoundry.com. Sacramento, foggy early afternoon, otherwise a cloudy Monday, highs 49 to 56, cloudy again tonight, some fog certainly couldn't return overnight, down to 41 for the low. For the Bay Area, generally mostly sunny the rest of today, highs in the low 50s to the low to mid 60s. Dry weather through the rest of the week, the next chance for rain forecast around December 15th.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
It's Here and Now. The last public execution in the U.S. happened less than a century ago in Kentucky. Rainey Bethea was a black man accused of raping a white woman. His hanging in 1936 is now at the center of a new book. From the Appalachia and Mid-South newsroom, Derek Operley has the story.
Bill Shelton painted a shocking picture of the scene from Rainey Bethea's hanging.
Everybody went. Everybody had a wonderful time. And it was over just like that.
That's from a 2013 Davis County Public Library interview Shelton gave before his death. In it, he remembers the festive atmosphere, the sea of people gathered around the scaffolding as Bethea walked calmly to his death.
They came from everywhere. And there was hawkers. They sold sandwiches and they sold Coca-Colas. And you'd have thought it was a big picnic or something.
In her new book, American Bloodlines, Reckoning with Lynch Culture, Owensboro native Sonia Lee examines the 1936 case through court records, contemporary reporting, and her own family history. Lee was inspired to look into the case after learning her grandparents attended the hanging as newlyweds, and in her research, she learned she was related to the prosecuting attorney. She says it's made her think harder about racial violence.
There's just so many things layered up where things could have been different for Rainey Bethea. But at the same time, we can start to see the connections how racial violence is still evident in our communities.
On a summer morning in 1936, a 70-year-old white woman named Elza Edwards was found dead in her Owensboro home. A local doctor determined she'd been strangled and raped, and 2 days later, authorities shifted the investigation to Bethea, a black man in his 20s who Edwards had hired to work in her home. The prosecution used Bethea's fingerprints found in the room he was paid to clean. They were not on the victim's body. Lee says the evidence against Bethea was flimsy.
One of the things that we can do through this case is to look and see how it might have been possible that justice would have been done. And that just takes a little bit of curiosity.
Bethea was charged only with rape, not murder. That's because they wanted to use an archaic Kentucky law that punished convicted rapists with public hanging.
They brought an old law out of hiding so that they could then try for rape alone and hang.
A murder charge would have carried a sentence of death by electric chair. After just 4.5 minutes of deliberation by an all-white jury, Bethea was found guilty. His defense counsel called no witnesses and delivered no closing argument. A little more than 2 months passed between Edward's death and Bethea's hanging, and in the run-up, a media circus descended on the town. Public hangings had been common in the U.S. in the 1800s, but by the 1930s, they'd been on the decline for decades, as attitudes changed and many states started to have executions in private by gas chamber or by electric chair. So this rare public spectacle in 1936 drew around 20,000 people. Today, there is no historical marker on the riverfront where Bethea was executed. That's something Rondalyn Randolph has been wanting to do for more than a decade. She's the president of the local NAACP and leads the Owensboro Community Remembrance Project.
It shows a respect to Rainey's humanity. It shows that our community is not that community anymore, and we're able to move forward by doing, you know, the right thing.
Sensational nationwide coverage of Bethea's public hanging embarrassed many in Kentucky, leading the state to ban the practice 2 years later. For NPR News, I'm Derek Operley in Owensboro, Kentucky.
Hey,
President Trump is pursuing aggressive policies in the Western Hemisphere that include anti-immigration crackdowns, military strikes on suspected drug smugglers, and threats of regime change in Venezuela. His administration is now reaching back two centuries and calling the approach the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's after BBC World Service News overnight. Morning Edition tomorrow at 2. In the meantime, it's a tense day at the Good Karma Hospital. Lydia and Marie clash over how best to support Jyoti. AJ takes on a patient with mysterious abdominal pain, and Ruby, still shaken by everything that happened with Gabriel, struggles to find her footing again. Don't miss the season finale of Good Karma Hospital tomorrow at 8 p.m. on KQED+. Support for KQED comes from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. And Block Construction, service-minded builders striving to enhance California communities, building schools, housing, and more. Block Construction, helping build futures since 1970. Info at block.com, BLACH.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And City Space Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or establish thought leadership. WBUR.org/creative studio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now. France, Germany, and the UK are trying to shore up Europe's support for Ukraine. Leaders from the three countries met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in London today. Zelensky has stressed the need to keep the United States on his side, but that hasn't been easy in the first year or so of President Trump's second term. And Trump's new national security strategy is amplifying those concerns. It's also providing a window into how the president sees his role in the world. Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh joins us now. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, always good to speak with you. Thanks for joining us again.
I'm happy to do it, Peter. Thank you.
Each administration typically comes out with a national security strategy. It's basically a roadmap for how the White House sees the world. What were some of the broad themes that struck you about this new document from President Trump?
Well, in some ways, in terms of broad themes, they're the broad themes we've come to associate with the president. He wants full control and strength and wants to be dominating but doesn't want to be on the hook for everything that happens. He wants other people to step up and do stuff. Sort of that's emotionally where it's at, but I'll tell you from a policy standpoint, and this is not a policy document really, but from a policy standpoint, the big takeaway for me is it is sort of the beginning, the first official announcement of the beginning of the end of NATO. At least that's one way to take it. Remember, NATO is the most important national security alliance that the United States is part of, always has been, the most important and the most significant. And the language in there essentially says, hey, Europe, we want you to be able to defend yourself, but we're not here for you. It says it in many different ways, but most particularly in language where it says we want to stand up the Europeans so they can defend themselves. That sounds like someone's getting out of town.
Interesting. Let's talk more about Europe and what this document says. It doesn't come up, Europe doesn't come up until page 25 in a 29-page document. But what it does say, as you're implying, is quite interesting here. It mirrors what Vice President Vance said back in February at a speech he gave in Munich when he claimed that European democracies are censoring far-right political opposition. Let's listen.
And I believe deeply that there is no security if you are afraid of the voices, the opinions, and the conscience that guide your very own people. Europe faces many challenges, but the crisis this continent faces right now, the crisis I believe we all face together, is one of our own making. If you're running in fear of your own voters, there is nothing America can do for you.
We had Vance's speech. Now we have this document. What's your read? Let's go more into Trump's view on Europe and NATO.
Yeah, I think it's a straight line, Peter. You start back in the first term. He has conversations with the national security staff saying, why am I in NATO? Why do I care about old Europe? I hate them. They don't like me. But it doesn't go anywhere because Trump has a lot of people who are slowing him down. He can't do what he wants to do. Then we have the administration kick off its foreign policy with Vance visiting this Munich conference and essentially insulting the Europeans, you know, who are at war. They're involved in a war on their border. No talk of that, really. We're just going to say that you're undemocratic. So I thought that was a bad sign. But it's really the language in the European section, which is clearly the most provocative. It really runs, for the first time that I remember in any national security document, has these Trump themes of ethno-nationalism and racialism and cultural purity. He doesn't use the word purity, but he might as well have. Really sort of ugly stuff that you haven't seen in previous documents, official national security documents of this kind. But again, it reflects sort of Trump's disposition to Europe and certainly Vance's as well.
The White House strategy document says on the war in Ukraine with Russia, it says it is a core interest of the United States to negotiate a quick end to the war and to mitigate the risk of Russian confrontation with other countries in Europe. Jim, that is interesting because it does not name Russia as a national security threat.
It does not name Russia as a national security threat throughout the entire document. It's sort of hard to imagine how you could write a national security strategy, have a four-year-old war in the heart of Europe, and not mention Russia's invasion. But that's what it does, and it's pretty clear it's saying, and you see this in the other language too, what we want is strategic stability. And what do they say when they use that weird phrase? What they're saying is, we don't want Europe and Russia to fight. That's way different than saying what we've always said, which is, we'll defend Europe. We'll defend Europe. And now we're saying, well, we don't want violence. We're going to try to minimize the prospects of violence between these two people. Well, if you're Europe, you're hearing them shift your position, and it's a really noisy shift.
I'm speaking with Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh about the Trump administration's new national security strategy, which came out just a few days ago. And Jim, let's kind of move around the globe a little bit, because the Monroe Doctrine of 1823 makes an appearance in this document. The original was a warning by President James Monroe that other countries better not interfere with its interests in the Western Hemisphere. What do we need to know about that?
Well, I think what it's done is in some ways extend what Trump has already said. He's tried to kick the Chinese out in terms of their involvement with the Panama Canal, and he made different moves to make sure or to try to prevent China from having a bigger footprint in the region. Some more successful, some less successful. But I think here we get basically both Trumps, right? Trump is not one person. He's several different people with different impulses that are contradictory, that shift from moment to moment. So on the one hand, he wants to be king of Latin, you know, of South America, of the Western Hemisphere, of the part of the world in which the United States finds itself. And so we want to call the shots. We want to say what happens here. If some country wants to have relations with someone else, that's too bad for them because we're saying no. All right, that's one perspective. Then, with the rest of the world, whether it's Russia or China or the murderous monarchs of the Middle East, it's, hey, you know, let bygones be bygones, do what you want to do, live and let live. But we're going to own, so that's one message, live and let live, do what you want, I don't care. And then the other message is we're totally going to own the Western Hemisphere, and we're going to meddle in the affairs of our European allies. So it's really these are messages are cross-cutting and contradictory, if you ask me.
The document proposes a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, that border security is a primary element of national security. And I'm thinking about, we've been reporting on this for weeks now, the military strikes against suspected drug boats in the Caribbean certainly suggests to me that the Trump administration is ready and willing to use military might when it suits it.
Without doubt. I mean, He's changed the Department of Defense to the Department of War, at least in name, and at the same time is running for the Nobel Peace Prize, which, again, the document reads like exactly like that. It's filled with contradictions and moving in one place and moving in another. So, but clearly, by the allocation of U.S. military assets, you look at a map of where U.S. naval ships are, we have definitely amassed military power. It certainly looks like we might do something. We already attacked and bombed Iran. So we say we're for peace except when we want to have war.
You briefly mentioned China. We should talk about that because the news today is that China's trade surplus with the world has surpassed $1 trillion so far this year for the first time ever. And the document does, in fact, talk about China almost in, is it purely economic terms?
Yes, it's purely economic terms. Now, there are references to, cyber activity and, meddling in our neighborhood, in our backyard. That's the whole, Monroe Doctrine thing, but and that has a security dimension to it. But you are 100% correct. Yes, it is mostly focused on the economics. And I will say, to be fair, Biden's strategy or equivalent document, which was terrible at the time, I thought it was a foreign policy for the middle class. I don't even know what that means when you're trying to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. But Biden was doing this too, right? We're going to focus our messaging on the domestic audience, and then they're doing it too. Migration. All of this, the economics, not much national security in the national security strategy.
All right. Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh, a senior research associate in the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, if you had to give this one a grade, what would it be?
not good. Not good. I'm not in favor of grade inflation, Peter. You're not going to get me to give him a high grade.
You're listening to Here and Now. Thanks, Jim.
Support for KQED comes from PG&E. Emergency planning means practicing how to open the garage door manually, considering backup power options, and packing a go kit. More at safetyactioncenter.pge.com. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. You're listening to KQED 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento. We're also live on the KQED phone app. Here and now until the top of the hour, then the early edition of All Things Considered and KQED Afternoon News.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And Made In, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel nonstick griddle for home use, designed for use indoors or outdoors, on a grill or over an open flame. More at madeincookware.com.
It's Here and Now. I was in Santa Monica, California over the weekend. Everyone was going over to 1002 22nd Street, the house that now late architect Frank Gehry built. It enraged neighbors at first, all chain-link fence and corrugated metals wrapped around an old pink bungalow. But now it's a tourist attraction, and people certainly flocked to it on Saturday after hearing that Frank Gehry, whose designs reshaped modern architecture, died Friday at the age of 96. He was born Frank Goldberg to a working-class family in Toronto. He went on to dazzle people around the world with sculptural, monumental buildings that seemed to tumble through the air, buildings like the Guggenheim Bilbao, the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, and the Pritzker Pavilion in Chicago. Design critic Alexandra Lang is here to help us, reflect on Frank Gehry. And Alexandra, I know you know that house in Santa Monica.
I do. It's a wonderful house. The house is so great because he took this very ordinary house that you could see really in any suburb in America in the post-war period, and he completely took it apart. It was like he said, we don't need to live in that kind of house anymore. I'm going to take all these ordinary materials that I spotted on construction sites around the neighborhood, and I'm going to make them into something fantastic.
Well, and he talked about other architecture at the time, you know, as modern architecture was starting, and, you know, homes that were perfect and set out in gorgeous landscapes. And he said, I would just feel like I'd have to pick up my clothes all the time. He just wanted to, you know, kind of be explosive. And as he said, use dumb, normal materials of the neighborhood. He said there must have been a half dozen cars in, you know, in deconstruction sitting around on lawns. There was chain link in people's backyards. That's what I wanted to use.
Yeah, I think he really wanted to demystify architecture, to make it not a luxury product, and to reconnect with some of the emotional qualities that it had for him. There were a lot of people in the 70s who were looking for a way out of modernism and who were reacting in some respects to the sense of crisis in America in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I think his house and his architecture were a reaction to both of those things and was also deeply personal.
Yeah. Talk about some of the other buildings. I'm thinking of the dancing house building in Prague, which is called Ginger and Fred.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful building. That's a series of two narrow, not skyscrapers, but mid-rise buildings. And one of them at the corner is sort of upright and solid. And then the one next to it just sways into it and is made of glass and steel. And they're called the Ginger and Fred buildings because there's a sense in which it's Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing together, this couple just coming together in this very sensual way. And that, again, is something you don't typically see in architecture, that sensuality, that sense of the body. And a lot of people read that into many of his buildings, including the Guggenheim Bilbao, which New York Times architecture critic Herbert Mouchamp famously compared to Marilyn Monroe in her dress, you know, blowing up above the subway vent.
Well, and, you know, there seemed to be a shift then. And I'm wondering if you note that too, because we talk about the early stuff where, you know, Frank Gehry is putting up chain link fence and, you know, he said he used to work with nuts and bolts in a hardware store when he was a kid, and he saw the beauty in that. And he also had a very disruptive life. He had a fight with his father on the front lawn, and his father had a heart attack. That stayed with him. They tip into near poverty, moved to L.A. It seemed as if a lot of what he was doing then was disruptive, was maybe reflecting, as you said, what was going on in the world, but also his own family and some of the stuff he'd seen. But then, did it get more elegant?
Yeah. I mean, I think, especially through the first, even, you know, 30 years of his career, he always felt like he was battling, you know, kind of battling to find his own voice, to find his place in architecture, battling against the establishment, you know, once he started using these rough and ready materials. And by the time the Guggenheim Bilbao came around, obviously he had enough of a reputation to have this, you know, world-class museum and its director come to him for architecture. And I think at that point he understood that, you know, he had to make it bigger, you know, make it more spectacular without losing some of the, you know, kind of forms and roughness that had originally, you know, made him an original architect.
Well, Frank Gehry was on Here and Now in 2020, and we asked what advice he had for young architects.
You know, when I started class with students, I asked them to write their signature, and they each write their signature. And I spread them out, and I say, look, you all have a different aesthetic when you write your signature. That's you, that's you, that's you, that's you. So there is a you that comes naturally. So stick with it.
A you that comes naturally.
I love that.
Yeah. Every building that he did was him.
Yeah. And I would say that some architects try to do that and they can't pull it off, but he definitely pulled it off.
Yeah. Frank Gehry worked into his 90s. There's a museum of his under construction in Taiwan right now. But he has left, died at the age of 96. Design critic Alexander Lang, thank you for helping us remember his remarkable work. And again, we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm writing my signature right now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
For decades, Alice Wong spoke of the need for disabled people to advocate loudly for their own health needs. It's been less than a month since Alice Wong's death, and I wanted to know who in her community is going to keep this fight going, this fight for disability justice. I'm Carlos Cabrera Lomelí, and I'm the community engagement reporter at KQED. You can find my story about Alice Wong's legacy at kqed.org.
All things considered, a minute away after Julie Deppish with afternoon traffic starting in Fremont.
And a problem coming off the Sunol Grade on South 680 before Mission Boulevard North. You've got a two-vehicle wreck in the left lane, so there's a bit of a backup to Vargas Road. Dealing with a stall on the Altamont Pass, West 580 after Grantline Road. That's a delivery truck in the right lane. The tow truck is there. And also a stall in the Santa Cruz Mountains on Highway 17 South before Idlewild Road. That conked out in the right lane. Major backup to Bear Creek Road. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from SF Jazz, presenting trumpet superstar Chris Bode January 5th through the 11th. The Grammy-winning musician has performed alongside Yo-Yo Ma, Herbie Hancock, Josh